when you just can't find a deal that works. And then what happens is you get impatient and you try to force something. It happens to every trader. It's like, I can't find anything stock worth buying. Everything's overpriced. Well, if it's overpriced based on your metrics and your comfort level, there's nothing you can do about that.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
What's going on, everyone? I'm Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. Welcome back to another Finance Fridays. Every Friday, we jump into a topic on personal finance so we can get your money working for you, share some tips and tricks to stay away from the common pitfalls that a lot of people fall into when it comes to personal finance, and also just strategies to get you ahead. Because after all, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And I know I say that a lot, but it's true. You shouldn't just be focusing on increasing your income, which that is probably one of the biggest things to focus on, but it's not the only thing. Because yeah, you could make $1 million a year, but you could be blown it all, right? Versus someone making 150, 200 and having a lot more saved and being able to do a lot more things. So it's about getting that money to work for you. So then you can go live the type of lifestyle you want instead of creating income from one stream and then using that to fund that lifestyle. That's how you fall into a lot of trouble, especially if there's a downturn, recession, or you fall on hard times. That's when it makes it tough. But if you take that money you make from your main income source or your main couple of income sources, and then you put that into an investment or a strategy that can then make you even more money, and then that cash flow you can live off. That's the smart way. And that's the tips and strategy I want to share every Friday. And on today's episode, I'm interviewing a gentleman by the name of Henry Doss. And Henry, he calls himself a serial entrepreneur. He's created a bunch of different businesses. He started off an IT company where he would sell Macs back in the day when everyone was using PCs. For those of my younger listeners, you probably didn't know that time ever existed, but trust me, it did. Had a leasing company, did home specs, home theaters. Now he's even getting into selling real estate. But he also has a coaching business where he coaches entrepreneurs, both from a standpoint of entrepreneurship, growing, building a business, but also from a personal finance perspective. He's been trading stocks his entire life since he was 17. And it seems like he's gotten really good at it. And so he gives a lot of advice on that. And we just talk about a lot of different things, from risk reward ratios that, like he mentions, that's one of the biggest pitfalls people make, is they don't assess risk properly. You get into that whole shiny object syndrome. You're like, so-and-so did amazing on crypto. So-and-so did amazing on self-storage. And you just want to jump into it without assessing the risk. And so that's a great topic we jump into. And it's just a really good episode for any entrepreneur, investor out there to get your mind right when it comes to financial intelligence. He even has a book on that called Financial Intelligence, and he calls it FQ. So I would definitely check that out. And I do want to mention that there was some connection issue. I'm not sure if it was my side or Henry's, but from the audio I was receiving, it sounded like he was cutting out a few times. We're going to have our audio engineers fine-tune that and try to make it better, but I'm not sure if that'll happen. So my apologies. Hopefully you can hear what he said, because he did give a lot of great stuff. But without further ado, let's introduce Henry. Hey, Henry, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to jump on today.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's just get right into it. Everyone loves a good origin story. So tell myself and the listeners a little about Henry.
Okay. So the backstory, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I started my first business in 1991. So it's over 30 years. Was an IT company. I actually started by selling Apple computers to corporations, which was a real challenge because corporations all use PCs. So it was pretty interesting back in what I sometimes affectionately call the pre-internet days. And we've seen all sorts of different stuff go on over the past couple of decades. We spawned a leasing company. I was in the factoring business. I built spec houses. I had a home theater business 20 years ago that we started as plasma screens were just coming to the market. We built these idiotically expensive home theaters for people that they're now ripping out and turning into gyms. So it's kind of funny how the trend has changed. But yeah, that's pretty much the backstory. I recently got my real estate license here in the state of Connecticut. So I call myself the world's oldest rookie real estate salesperson. So yeah, do a lot of fun stuff.
Wow. You have done a lot.
Yeah.
From IT, spec homes, leasing company, home theaters, now rookie real estate salesperson. Mm-hmm. So what's your kind of goal with a real estate license?
Well, you know, part of it was kind of a bucket list thing, but I just never really got around to it. And then we bought this house here in Connecticut. We closed in December of 20. So it's the end of March in 22. So we moved in April of last year. So we've been here about a year. And the transaction was just awful. You know, everybody's talked about the horror stories that are going on, the bidding wars and the paying over ask. We inadvertently got involved in that, even though it wasn't our plan. Our plan was we were empty nesters and we wanted to move out of the New York area and kind of downsize. We just got caught up in the traffic, but we've done enough real estate transactions to know that if you got to bid over the ask, you bid over the ask, and cash is king. So the funny thing was that we had bid over the ask. There were at least a dozen other bids, a bunch of which were greater than ours, but nobody else bid cash. So the sellers did the smart thing and took our offer. But the transaction itself was so awful. The agents were just so incompetent that that really just kicked me into gear and said, you know what? It was on the list. Let's do it. Right? How hard could it be? 60 hours of Zoom calls and take a test.
There you go.
That was pretty much it.
Well, that sounds like the quintessential entrepreneur to me. When you see there's an error or you find a way of doing something better and you jump in. So that sounds like that to me.
In angel investor groups and stuff. And the pitch is always the blah, blah, blah business is broken. Our newfangled gizmo or app or SaaS product fixes it, right? How many times have you heard that story?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's just kind of how it was. Now, I'm not trying to fix the real estate business. I am trying to kind of build my own little franchise that maybe differs a little bit from the basic stuff that people are doing. But it's still a work in progress. There's still a lot of marketing and a lot of other things that have to be done. And the other reason is I wanted to be able to, I guess, see how the sausage is made. Right. It was always a bit of a real estate. It was always a bit of a black box if you're on the other side. But once you get access to the MLS and you kind of see all the gory details, you can get a little better sense for how the process works.
Yep. I want to talk about your book, Financial Intelligence FQ. I know that I really want to hear about it. And I know my listeners would because we have a lot of entrepreneurs, investors. So I would love to hear more about the book if you wouldn't mind talking about that.
In my origin story, I kind of skipped over what I've been doing for the last almost 10 years, which is as an entrepreneurial coach. So I've been coaching business owners, people who are where I was 30 years ago. That's been my main avocation. But then a couple of years ago, I was in Bangkok at a conference for location-independent businesses, digital nomads, many of whom were my clients and are still my clients. And I was sitting at a mastermind table with a group of coaches, and we were talking about our Jim Collins big hairy BHAG. And I said, I really want to write a course about finance that I could share my 40 years of experience because I've been investing. I bought my first stock when I was 17. I was still in high school, and I've been managing my own money, investing and growing it, if I might say, rather successfully over my adult lifetime, and not even professionally, just as kind of a regular guy doing it for themselves. So I felt I had a lot of wisdom, and I did. I came back and I wrote the course and then enlisted a dozen volunteers. I tested the curriculum. And then a few people said, this would make a really good book. You should turn it into a book. That'll be your lead magnet. People will read the book, and then they'll want to learn it from the master. And that took me down this year-long rabbit hole of actually creating a book, because when I was building it, I never anticipated that I would actually be publishing this on paper and putting it out into the world. And there's just a different set of rules. 250 infographics. I had to hire a guy on Fiverr out of Serbia to convert them into vector files. That was something I hadn't anticipated. But my designer said, you can't print this stuff. It'll look terrible. So weird things like that. But yeah, the goal was give people, it's sort of a money memoir matched up with a kind of a lineage from cradle to grave for everything I thought the average person would need to know in order to manage money themselves, or to be able to hire a money manager and manage them and ask intelligent questions.
I think that's the most important part too. Like, if you're not going to do it yourself, you need to know what questions to ask, because
sure,
there's a lot of, I don't know if shady is the right term, but maybe it is. There's a lot of stuff going on out there that shouldn't be.
Shady is a perfectly good word to use for a lot of the stuff. It's actually a very kind word for a lot of the stuff that's going on in the financial world.
Yeah, so I think it's important. So I don't know if you give us a little taste of the book, maybe what are some of the questions people should be asking or common pitfalls?
Well, the way I structured the book is one of the other things I do in my infinite leisure is I'm a screenwriter. So I've written 11 screenplays and I've done them for fun. I've entered them into contests. I've had professionals read them. It is another bucket list item of mine to have one of these films produced. But my feeling is that if it's going to get produced, I'm going to have to do it myself. So it's looming out there. So I structured the book as a three-act story. You know, most every TV show or screenplay follows a three-act structure. The first act is this kind of the setup. So the first six chapters cover the psychology of money, which is chapter one, personal net worth, your personal balance sheet, your personal income statement, income and expenses. The goal is that by the end of chapter six, we kind of know what it is you have and what's coming down the line, what contingent liabilities, right? What are those things looming off in the distance that you have to prepare for? Retirement being a big one, your children's education, right? Let's say you're 30 years old and you're doing this exercise. You might have a very nice net worth now, but when you look at all those expenses coming down the line, you realize that, you know, I'm underwater. So I got to get going on all this stuff. The second act is where I talk about the nuts and bolts, stock investing, real estate investing, commodities, cryptocurrency, whatever it is, bond market, all of those things to give people an understanding of how they work and what would be required to successfully trade in those marketplaces. And then the third act is sort of all the other stuff, tax related stuff, IRAs and Roth IRAs and Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare and your last will and testament. And then I have a whole chapter that I call Gypsy Tramps and Thieves, which is all about the charlatans and the shady operators and how they're trying to take your money from you and how to protect yourself. Right? Buy a shredder and shred those paper documents that you shouldn't be getting anyway. You should be getting them electronically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like, and they should be stored on an encrypted drive kind of stuff. And then at the end, you die, right?
Yep.
And that's it.
End scene.
Fade out is what we say in the screenwriting world.
That's funny. Well, that sounds like a phenomenal book. I'm interested in taking a look. So I will look that up.
You can download it for free. Just go to henrydoss.com. Right on that's my vanity. That's not even his page. That's just my vanity page that has like my baseball card collection, pictures of my recent trip at my safari to Africa and stuff like that. Has my business stuff too, but right on it, it has a link and you can download it for free. So all your listeners, have at it.
That's great. Thank you, Henry. I'm sure there'll be a lot of value in there. So listeners, I would definitely take advantage of that and check it out. So you do a lot of coaching. What are some common mistakes or pitfalls you see entrepreneurs fall into? Because I know there's a lot out there.
Well, so I have two different coaching disciplines. I coach entrepreneurs about everything business related.
Yeah.
And then I coach entrepreneurs and regular personal finance. But the parallels are there. There's a lot of parallels there. And I guess the biggest one, somebody asked me on another podcast, and I've done a lot of these about what's like the biggest takeaway. And I talk about risk, assessing risk. Most people suck at assessing risk. They just do. They have no idea, right? They'll say, you know, I got FOMO. I want to get into Bitcoin. I want to get into crypto. Everybody's becoming a gazillionaire, right? And they don't think about what are the risks involved, right? Same thing with the stock market, real estate, et cetera, et cetera. Everything has both known and unknown risks that you need to assess. And anytime you are trying to assess a return on investment, right, an ROI on some sort of product, looking at the raw ROI is one thing, but looking at the risk-adjusted ROI is a whole nother thing. So something that's, you have to assume that something that's doing, you know, 50%. I remember back in the go-go, right before the dot bomb, the turn of the century, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I got a call from a guy and he said, our fund returned 200% last year. And this year we anticipate 300%, right? I swear, this was a real phone call. I was at the office. I said, I got to be honest with you. If you had come to me and told me that you could get me 8% pretty much guaranteed with no risk, I would give you all of my money.
Yeah.
But I'm not 200, 300. Sorry, you're in a fantasy world. I'm not doubting you did 200%. Try doing that year after year. Try beating it hard enough. And I'm not even a believer in any of the indexes. I talk a lot about it, how index funds and all that stuff is just an arbitrary illusion. Come up with a return that you're comfortable with. What would you like to make? I'd like to make 7% after tax, right? Be a pretty good return if you could do that for a very low risk.
Yep.
And then figure out how you're going to do that. But people don't. They just chase things or...
shiny object syndrome.
Yeah, follow just some trend or listen. One of the things, although it's going to be a little contrarian because I'm giving people somewhat of advice here, is to shut all that off. Right? I wrote about it in the book, how I botched a trade because I was listening to guys on CNBC. And that was years ago. And from that day forward, I never listened to those shows. I never turned them on. Bloomberg, CNBC... I have a few trusted resources that I use, and I have a bunch of tools, some of which are homegrown, and that's what I follow. And I ignore all the pump and dump and all the stuff that's out there in the world trying to separate me from my money.
Exactly. And that's what they're there for. That's how they make money, when they separate it from you, the investor. So,
right. Ask yourself, anytime you get pitched something, what's in it for them? Forget about you. Why are they offering this? Anytime a manufacturer goes out there and changes the business model, right? Remember in the software business, we used to sell software and we would sell Quark Express for $500, $600 a pop to our corporate clients. That business model has changed completely now. Now it's a subscription service because they figured out, I don't want to sell it to you once. I want recurring revenue.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't go and you buy Adobe Photoshop for $500. You pay $20 a month. And they'll give you free upgrades and all that stuff. But over the course of time, they are making much more money on you.
Yeah. Right?
And only a fool would believe that they changed that because it was benefiting you. Yeah, they're not in the business of benefiting you. They've got shareholders.
Yeah. It's like Apple with the iPhone in the recent years. And they removed...
they just changed their model again.
They removed the adapter for the charger and the headphones, saying it was better for the environment because less packaging. But then it came out in their annual statement that it saved them billions, or it made them billions of dollars.
I think they just changed the iPhone. It's like a leasing thing. You know, they used to sell them, and then they would lease them, and then they would sell them. They're constantly looking at a way to squeeze more revenue out of it. And as an entrepreneur, you got to do the same thing.
100%. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you can only cut expenses so far before it's just you're down to the bone. And sometimes it's the law of diminishing returns. You start cutting expenses so much that it impacts your ability to do business. And then that's not a good prescription for things. But on the other side of things is, as a consumer, I don't want to feel like I'm being ripped off.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff out there that is like, it was interesting. I just got, right before we went online here, I need a new staircase for this house that we bought. This house dates to the 19th century.
Wow.
And the staircase is a disaster and we need to change it. We need something that's a little more senior friendly. And the guy, I found a few people online, and he writes me back. I sent him a very copious description of what it is that we're doing. And he says, well, I could send somebody up there, but we charge $95 to do the measurements. Now, I've already had somebody here to do the measurements who didn't charge me anything. Yeah. And my feeling as an entrepreneur and as an entrepreneurial coach is, nah, no, that's your cost of doing business, not mine.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
That I think is just a bad business practice. I've never done it. My wife's an entrepreneur as well. She's never done it. Never, ever charged anybody for an estimate. And there are enough people out there who don't charge for an estimate. So why would you do that? $95, really? Is your life in a balance? This is probably a $15,000 job. Why would you nickel and dime me from day one to replace my staircase by charging me for a guy to measure it. Heck, I can go measure it for you. I'm an engineer. I know how to work a tape measure.
Yeah, that's true. It's probably because his prices are so out of whack that he doesn't win most bids. So he has to cover his expenses somehow.
I don't know. And frankly, I don't really care because it's kind of a commodity business. I've had staircases replaced in other houses too. And I go out to a bunch of guys and I find a guy that I like and I say, build the thing for me and come and install it. Right?
Yeah. No, my point was just he probably needs to look at his business model from top down to assess why is he charging that fee?
Right. I mean, I might even ask him. You make a good point. Maybe I'll send him back. Maybe I'll send him a note and say, explain to me why you charge $95.
Yeah.
Is it because the price of gas is up to $5 and the cost of driving here? I mean, it does. Gas has gotten... Funny thing is actually still cheap compared to what it is historically, but people see the number $5. Oh my God. When you consider in 1979, gas was $1.25 during the oil embargo. So if you adjust for inflation, it's still significantly higher than it is today, but people don't know that.
Right. Well, the media is not going to let them know that. I'm glad you brought up risk and the expense part. There's only so much you can bring down because that's a big thing. I personally think in the real estate market right now, with so much money getting dumped into it because they're just chasing yields and appreciation we've seen in the last 2 years, both from just appreciation on the asset itself, but also rent appreciation. There's a lot of risk because people are still analyzing deals based, at least I think they are, based on the assumptions that they're going to see. Maybe not quite as much appreciation, but still more than they should be analyzing the deal, underwriting the deal with, especially when it comes to rates rising. We don't know where that's going to go.
Correct.
Yes, there is a huge deficit in housing units in this country. So the demand's there. But what happens if there is some type of pullback? And yeah, you could fill that unit, but are they going to pay? Where is your economic vacancy going to be at? Who's actually going to be paying? So that's one thing. I'm glad you said that. I want to bring that up to the listeners. When you're analyzing deals, you got to take that into account. I know you want to get deals to work so you can submit an offer, but what happens 2-3 years down the road and you lose that deal? You got to be really, you got to analyze the risk and reward ratio and don't feel like you have to get the deal today. Be smart about it.
Yeah, years ago, I have some folks that are kind of like my trading mentors, guys who have taught me a lot of stuff. So I was on a webinar with one of them and I asked him about a stock that I wanted to trade. It was a $400 stock, which today is not that big a deal, but it was kind of a big deal. And he said to me, what are you trying to prove by trading this stock, right? There's so many other stocks out there that you could trade. Why are you going to trade this highly volatile, very expensive stock? Move on. And it's the same thing. It can be frustrating, especially in the real estate business, when you just can't find a deal that works. And then what happens is you get impatient and you try to force something. Mm-hmm. It happens to every trader. It's like, I can't find anything stock worth buying. Everything's overpriced. Or I can't find a building worth buying. It's all overpriced. Well, if it's overpriced based on your metrics and your comfort level, there's nothing you can do about that. You can make some lowball offers and see if somebody nibbles, but if they don't force it. And that's a very tough lesson for people to learn. And the other thing that you talked about is don't look at today's metrics, right? If you look at today's residential numbers, I think they said year over year, residential houses are up about 20%, right? That's a huge aberration, mm-hmm. huge aberration. Don't base your ongoing assumptions on that 20% number. Go back and look at a historical number over some protracted time period, 10 years, 20 years, right? When I look at price earnings ratios, I use something called the Shiller PE, which is the 10-year PE, not the one-year PE. Now, sometimes the one-year PE is appropriate, but generally speaking, I want to look at it over the course of time because I'm a long-term investor. If you're a flipper, that might be a different ballgame. But if you're buying an MDU because you want to hold it over a period of years and you want to manage it, look at the historical number that matches your time frame and use that when you do your calculations. And also when you're looking at expenses, it's the same thing. For instance, I have a friend who owns a multi-unit student housing at a New York public university. We were on a call the other day and he said, I got a little bit of a problem because the fuel costs have gone up so significantly and our students, they just pay a flat number, right? And I can't go back to them and say, hey, I can't add a surcharge to this. I don't have the ability to do that within the lease, the way the lease is written.
Right.
So I said, well, you might want to take a look at the lease moving forward and put some kind of a clause in there that gives you the ability to do that if fuel is going to be volatile. But otherwise, yeah, you're kind of stuck for this year. I mean, and it's significant expense. So there's a perfect example of a contingent liability, an unknown, something that you hadn't really anticipated. What people who, in this particular example, do is they use the futures market, right? That's what the futures market's there for. And you buy contracts on fuel, and where your fuel supplier is now obligated to provide it to you at the cost of the contract, not at market rate. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a risk. If it goes up, if the spot goes up, you benefit. But if it goes down, you're going to pay more than the current rate. But at least it's locked in.
Right.
It's a number, and I know what it is. And for me, I'd rather have the predictability, sort of like what they did with phone plans, right? For years and years and years, they had all these overage charges. It used to drive me crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Give me an unlimited plan. I don't care. I'm not going to sit there and micromanage it. I just want to know, this is going to cost me $100 a month, no matter how much I talk.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know, because that I can hang my hat on. But variable costs, that's tough and that's risky.
Yeah. It makes it easier to budget when it's fixed. So buying all futures, I get that. Yeah, you might pay more if in the market if it goes down, but you know it's going to fit into your budget more the other way.
Absolutely.
Blow your budget up. I'm glad you brought that up. That's a good point. We don't, most of our properties, they do pay for most of their utilities, but we also do own some student housing. So that is a very good point. Right now it is volatile, and let's face it, it affects your returns, and there's nothing we can do about it. So
your lease is a living document, right? That's why they have a rider on the end of it. I mean, I'd leased a space in New York for 20 years, and I was very good friends. You know, still am pretty good friends with the landlord. And every time we renewed the lease, we had to sign a new rider, and it was always different. I'm like, do I got to read this again, Jeffrey? He goes, yeah, you do. I added some stuff. I said, give me an example of what you added. He said, well, I added something that says you can't run a pornographic business out of your space. I said, really? Why did you add that? He said, because I had a guy who rented a space and he was running a pornographic business out of the space. And I don't like that. His neighbors didn't like that. And so after the fact, I had to add another clause into the rider that says you're prohibited from running those kind of businesses in any of my 600 spaces. I said, all right, makes total sense. So, and I think most landlords know that's not just some boilerplate, which was another thing in my real estate transaction that went on here in Connecticut, because we'd never bought in Connecticut before. But the contract is created by the agent, by the real estate agent. I'm like, this is supposed to be created by a lawyer. The last house I bought in Westchester had a 5-page rider on it. And this had no rider. It was like, it just had what it had. I'm like, and it had no time is of the essence clause. And I said, I flagged that. And the lawyer said, we should just keep that under our hat. I said, no kidding. How could they put in a contract that doesn't have a time is of the essence clause? I'm not a lawyer, but I've done enough transactions to know, yeah, you want to have that in there. And sure enough, we missed the closing date. And then they sent us the time is of the essence letter. And I'm like, oh, well, I bought myself 30 days for free that I never should have gotten. Right?
Yeah.
I flagged it immediately. And so did my lawyer. And he said, well, we're just going to keep our mouth shut and sign it the way it is. And that's exactly what happened. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Listeners always use an attorney. There are, because there are states, it's not just Connecticut, that the agent creates the agreement. And
it's just, I don't understand. Why are non-lawyers creating legal contracts?
Right.
That's just weird.
Yeah, always cover yourself, because we're not professionals when it comes to that. That's why they get paid the big bucks. So use them.
Exactly. Another cost of doing business.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's just, you got to pay a couple grand for a lawyer. Do it. Could save you a fortune later down
right,
the line.
Right. Exactly. A couple grand up front could save you tens of thousands of dollars or more.
Absolutely.
100%. All right. This has been a great conversation. But before we get going here, is there anything else that you want to bring up? I know. Is there like a big money trap that you see people make? I know that would probably be beneficial to listeners.
Sure. There's a couple. I was talking about one the other day with somebody about being over-diversified or under-diversified. So, you know, I have a client, does very well, entrepreneurial client, probably close to a $20 million business now. And when I started with him, it was a $1 million business like 5 years ago. So really kind of gone parabolic. And every once in a while, he'll ask me to help him out, go over with his investments and stuff. He owns three stocks and he's got seven figures in them, Tesla, Apple, and I think Adobe. And I say, you know, you might want to consider some other sectors, right? You might want to consider diversifying a little bit. Sure, your return will take a hit, but so will the risk involved. And then I've got other people that I deal with who talked about, you mentioned shiny object syndrome. Well, they just want to buy like everything that's out there, right? And they're over-diversified. And then you got the folks who are like, oh, I'm just going to put money in the S&P 500 index fund and let it go and not look at it. It's like, no, you don't want to do that either. You want to come up with a formula that works for you. And I wrote about it in my book. At one point in time, I owned 45 different stocks. And this was maybe 10, 12 years ago. And then I went on a trader's retreat in China, actually, in Macau. And I kind of got the impression from everybody that I was a little over-diversified. And I said, you know what? I'm going to limit it to 20. I call it the DAS 20. But over the last few years, it's been maybe 12. I've got 12 stocks in my portfolio. I have rules because that's about as much as I can manage. It gives me enough flexibility to diversify across sectors. And there are 11 different sectors. And usually either tech or finance is the leader on a year over year basis. And then energy was a laggard for a bunch of years. And then this past year, energy went crazy and beat everybody. So you want to look at your portfolio and you want to rotate out of stuff that's past its prime and rotate into stuff that's got a higher growth opportunity. That requires some management on your part. So just dumping it all into the S&P 500, sure, you're diversified, but you're going to do as well as the market does. And sometimes markets do great. Last year, I think the S&P was up 28%. But in other years, like 2008, it was down 40%.
Right.
It takes a long time. When you have a downdraft, it just takes that much longer just to get back to even, no less to actually make money. When that goes down 40%, it's going to take you 3 years just to get back to where you were before that. That's tough. You cannot allow those kind of hits to your portfolio because it's the kiss of death.
Yeah, and I've talked about this before to the listeners. Volatility erodes your portfolio because if you lose a chunk, it takes a lot more just to get back to even break even.
It really, really does.
And I'm glad you brought up the whole diversification thing too, because yet, like you said, not even where you maybe over-diversified from a standpoint of hurting your returns, but also just managing that. I used to work for a fund company and funds would have 50, maybe up to 70, but that was even a lot. And you're talking about a fund that has 1 to 2 portfolio managers, a handful of analysts and a research team. And that's what they handle. I'm glad you brought that up.
I own mutual funds.
Yep.
And I look at their portfolio to make sure that we don't have too much overlap.
Yep.
I actually dump everything into a portfolio on Morningstar. And then they have a neat little tool that will show you, that actually will look at the mutual funds versus your stocks. And it'll kind of show you the overall weightedness. It would be really hard to do that manually. They'll do it for you right away. And you could say, oh, you know what? I didn't consider that this stock had so much in tech and now I'm overweight. I need to peel it back a little bit. Conversely, you may look at it and say, I don't have any exposure in the energy sector and it's kicking butt. So I need to up that. But again, whether you do that or you hire a professional to do that, and if you hire a professional, you can ask them, just give me those reports on a monthly basis so I can monitor what it is that you're doing. I just don't believe in the robo-investing. I don't believe in mobile investing. I tell people, don't ever buy or sell stocks from your phone or your iPad or anything like that. Always do it from the same place when you're nice and chill. I do a morning 5-question psychological profile. I've been doing it for years and years and years. I do morning homework and I always do it from the same machine. And when I trade, I always trade from the machine with my charts and everything. That will prevent you from impulse trading. It'll prevent you from FOMO. It'll prevent you from standing in a line at Starbucks and saying, oh, I think I'm going to buy this, right? Don't do that.
Yes.
That doesn't work.
Don't trade on emotion.
No.
And it's easy to do that from a phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad you brought that up. I know real estate investors can fall into that trap as well. It's not just equity traders, but real estate investors. You get attached to a piece of property and you're like, I got to have it.
Some little thing pops up on your phone and it's like, it's funny thing is it's actually how we, strangely enough, it's actually how we found out about this house is my wife was making an appointment for another house and a little Zillow alert popped up while she was talking to the broker and said, you know what? I want to see that house too. And that house ended up being the house we bought.
Awesome.
So, but again, it was just, we weren't executing the transaction online.
Right.
It was just informational, right? So if something pops up on your phone about some hot stock, great. Go back to your station, put it on a chart, go read the 8K or go look at the financials, do your homework, right? I remember years ago, I had never heard of Lululemon. I'm ashamed to admit, but I had never heard of them. And then somebody told me about them and I put them on a watch list and started watching them and traded them for a couple of years and made a whole bunch of money on Lululemon. But if somebody hadn't made me aware of it, it never would have been on my radar.
Right. That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. And this kind of comes to my last question, which maybe that was the piece of advice or you've already mentioned it, but I always ask if you had the whole quintessential, if you had the time machine to go back in time and tell your younger self as an entrepreneur one thing, what would that be?
I think I would, it's going to be sound contrarian to what I've actually said, but I think I probably would have told myself, take more risk,
yeah,
right? Because the biggest asset you have is time. So I'll be 63 this summer. So my time is, I got maybe 20 decent years left. So I have to adjust my risk for the fact that if I did get a drawdown, I don't have the time to get that money back. Right. I just don't. I just physically won't have the time. But if you're in your 30s or your 20s, you can take on more risk. You can. I'm not saying to be a riverboat gambler, but you have the luxury of time. If you go look at a 100-year chart of the Dow or the S&P, you'll see that it starts on the lower left and goes to the upper right. There's a whole bunch of wiggles in the middle and crashes of 87 and then 2001 and all that stuff. But basically, it is a bullish chart. If you buy good stuff and hold it for the long term and have the discipline to reinvest your dividends, it's really old school advice, but you can do well. You can do really well. People of modest means, like my parents, did very, very well in the markets by being smart and vigilant and not being impulsive. That's key.
That's some great advice right there. And I think it goes to the whole risk or reward thing, right? You can take more risk when you're younger.
Yeah.
Achieve that higher reward. And then you should phase it out as you get older.
Yeah. You should phase it out because and what you'll find is that your risk tolerance will adjust according to
that. No, I agree with that.
If I were following the cookie cutter rules, 100 minus your age, which would be 37% of my assets should be in stocks. Well, my assets, I got a lot more than 37%, but I've been doing this for 40 years. So the earlier you get started, the more comfortable you will be with it. Sort of like skiing, right? I learned to ski when I was 5 years old and I just went skiing. My wife is still kind of a 60-year-old beginner and I'm skiing down the green dots like it's nobody's business because I've been doing it for almost 60 years. I have a high level of confidence, but you start skiing at 60, it's terrifying.
Right.
And investing, whether it be real estate or currencies or stocks or bonds or whatever, it's a lot less terrifying if you start when you're young, right? You just get accustomed to it.
Yeah, like in anything.
Yeah, like anything.
Well, this has been an awesome show, Henry. I really appreciate your time. Other than your website, is there anywhere else listeners can find you?
So my business site is called Das Knowledge, D-A-A-S, Knowledge. If you misspell it, D-A-S-S, and people misspell my name all the time, that'll get you there too. That's kind of a belts and braces approach to it. That has stuff on my business coaching. It has a bunch of little freebies, you know, PDF. I have a 25-page PDF, 5 reasons small businesses fail. I have a whole bunch of different, I have a money quiz, a lot of freebie stuff. There's good stuff there. And you can download my book either there or at henrydoss.com. I have a weekly newsletter that I send out. So if you go into my funnel, you'll get that. I talk about sort of the headlines that I think, what I call FQers, my little burgeoning flock articles I think FQers should read to increase their financial intelligence. So yeah, all good stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I got a lot of this. I know listeners will, so I just wanted to thank you. All right, listeners, we'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.